This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello and welcome to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Join me for a chat with the star of Wicked the Musical, showing in Sydney from September 2014. Gemma Ricks plays the part of Elphaba and sings that breathtaking song Defying Gravity. She talks about why she loves the part of Elfie, how she puts on that green skin every day, and even gives us a demo of how Wicked sounds in Japanese. The federal budget revealed a $7.6 billion cut to overseas aid. We discuss that with Tim Costello from World Vision and talk about changes to welfare benefits for young unemployed people with Tony Nicholson from the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence. We'll meet the New Zealand school principal who threw out the playground rulebook and let kids engage in more risky behaviour like riding bikes and scooters at school and climbing trees. He found the kids not only had more fun, they also had less behavioural issues, less bullying and worked better in class. For Food Allergy Week, we catch up with Maria Sade from Allergy and Anaphylaxis Australia and find out why they want allergies to be a national health priority. Parenting expert Dr. Justin Colson shares his thoughts on how to deal with attention-seeking behaviour, and Ben McKechnie reviews the blockbuster release Godzilla. That's all coming up on the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Wicked the Musical is returning to Sydney later in the year. It's won over 90 international awards, including a Grammy, 3 Tonys and 6 Helpmans. The Australian production has enchanted audiences with its beautiful sets, extravagant costumes and a magical storyline that teaches us an age-old lesson. Don't judge a book by its cover. Gemma Ricks plays the part of Elphaba, a.k.a. the Wicked Witch of the West. Welcome to the program, Gemma. Hi.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, your character has always been a bit of an outcast. You know, people have assumed she's wicked, but she's actually just misunderstood. How integral is that to the success of the show?
Oh, I think it plays a massive part. You know, I think that everybody can relate to Elphaba in that way. You know, we've all been picked on and judged too quickly in life in certain circumstances, and so I think that everybody can relate to that. And I think it's a great message, because when you actually get to know somebody, then you know the truth of that person. And for Elfie's sake, all she's doing is trying to do good. So it's really important that just because someone has green skin doesn't mean that then she is a wicked witch, with the wizard telling all of Oz that she is this wicked character, to not always just believe what is read or said, to look a little deeper yourself and find out the truth about somebody.
Yeah, that's a great lesson. One of the most touching parts of this story is the friendship that develops between the former enemies, Glinda and Elphaba. How does that come about?
At first with the show, you get to meet that they were in Shiz University together. Mm-hmm. And they actually despise each other, which is normal for Elfie, because everybody despises her when they first meet her anyway because of her green skin. But I think that for Elphaba, she looks at Glinda, who has had such a privileged life and is quite spoiled, that she is, you know, someone that she doesn't really want to waste time getting to know. And they end up getting forced together by sharing rooms. Mm. And so that's when they get to know each other. And they, even though they're completely different people, they really do form an amazing friendship together. And it's quite beautiful to witness, and the respect that they have for each other and the friendship that grows throughout that time, throughout the musical, is quite beautiful to watch.
Mm. Now, speaking of the green skin, your skin is caked in this. I don't actually know what it is, but it's caked in green for each show. How much fun is it putting that on every day? Like, what is it? And how long does it take to put on and off, you know, for each show?
So it's actually a MAC makeup. So it is a proper makeup. So okay. It is actually, you know, relatively good for the skin. And what it actually is they used to use it for, well, they still use it for body work that they would do with body art of people. So it's, you add water to it with a big brush. And so it's actually quite light on the skin. But then the main thing is that then you have to have a lot of powder, which sort of sets it. Mm. And then you have it, obviously, every day. So you do start to look very, very green.
So if you were doing a couple of shows in a day, you know, a matinee and then an evening show, do you have to put it on and off twice?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Because for two reasons. Firstly, the character gets older. So what happens is they actually have Elfie darker, like her makeup for Act Two is quite deep. And so, you can't obviously reverse that. But then also just when you've done a whole show, you know, it's a 3-hour stint, your skin and you've been quite hot and you actually do really want to take it all off and start fresh.
How long does that take to do each day, can I ask?
About half an hour. I'm always the last one out.
Yeah, right. You're not wishing you auditioned for Glinda instead? It would be a lot easier.
I definitely can't sing Glinda, that's for sure. But, yeah, sometimes when I'm in the shower, I'm like, oh.
Yeah. I'm speaking to Gemma Ricks, who plays one of the main roles in Wicked that is coming to Sydney later on in the year. Now, Gemma, doing a show like this must be such a huge commitment. Does the rest of your life just go on hold during the rehearsal and performance period?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I've been playing the role for a while now, so it's almost normal for me to live like this. But I remember at first it was hard to sort of, you know, you can't do things that you would normally do. And they're simple things, they're things that you wouldn't even think about, like going to a restaurant on your night off. If it's a loud restaurant and people are talking and you're having to raise your voice, you can't sit there.
Well, look, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, this part requires quite a vocal range. So how do you take care of your voice when you're performing show after show?
There's lots of things, but firstly, the most important thing is technique, is vocally you really need to have, you know, the best technique that you could possibly have. And it's not just for the singing, but also for the speaking, because Elfie in particular, she is quite a feisty character, so she yells throughout the show. Mm. And when I first started, I didn't know how to do it safely, you know, without, you know, sort of really damaging the voice or just not being able to back it up the next day. So I had to learn how to find the right placement and how to yell safely. And so, yeah, so there's that element to it, technique, and then when you're out of work, you are really not talking.
Yeah, wow. And, so you can't be sociable. Limited. You can't go to someone's 40th or 30th time. Yeah.
No. Like, you can, but then, you know, the show won't be as good because you're tired and you're inflamed and, you know, at the end of the day, it's the most important thing is for the audience. So you're always thinking about that. And you always want to do a good show. So you don't even really miss it because you go, no, well, that's just the way it is and I want to make sure I do a great show for everybody.
Yeah. Now, you have played Elfie before, you mentioned, but I understand that one time you even had to perform in Japanese. What was that like?
Yeah, so when I first was whisked away into the Wicked world was actually when I was in Japan and I was doing another show in Universal Studios and they brought a condensed version of Wicked just to see how the Japanese people would respond to the show because it was back in 2006. So it was when Wicked was still fresh and new and they were thinking of bringing Wicked to Japan. And I auditioned for it and then had to learn all this dialogue that was all in Japanese. And then the songs were mostly in English, but had some mixture of Japanese in it. And they also had subtitles just in case I didn't say the right words and they didn't understand what I was saying.
Now, look, this might be pushing the friendship, but can you remember any of it? Can you give us a line of a song or a speech in Japanese?
It's quite funny how things sort of, like, I've forgotten a lot of them, but some of them just pop into my head. So, like, Hontoni ano ozono mohotsukai ni aero nante shinjirara nai wa.
That sounds fantastic. What were you actually saying?
It's about meeting the wizard, and it's so excited that I can't believe I'm going to meet the Wizard of Oz.
Was totally awesome. Did you actually speak Japanese before? Because it sounded really good.
Oh, no, not at all. So I learned it the parrot fashion way. So we had someone who was Japanese and recorded it on a CD, a bit slower than how they would speak. And because they work on tones, so things are said higher and lower at certain points, so you had to sort of make sure how it sounded to our ear, you had to say it that like that because that's how they understand their language.
Well, for a singer, you're used to listening to tones.
True. Then after I learnt it, then we had a Japanese person who then sort of said, you know, this word means this and this word means that, and just so you sort of know exactly phonetically also what your sentence is. So, yeah, so it was a massive learning experience for me and it was pretty cool.
Look, obviously having the lead role in Wicked is a pretty big deal, but other than that, what would be your dream role, Gemma?
Well, that's the thing. It's like Elfie honestly is. Like, she's a role of a lifetime. So I kind of came on this role, you know, early. So a lot of people strive for this this character. But for me, I kind of just sort of fell into it with it being in Japan and then getting the standby role originally in 2008 here in Australia. So it's really, I'm sort of living the dream, and obviously, you know, in the future I'd love to do lots of shows. But at the moment it's, you know, this is the role of a lifetime. So I'm really grateful and appreciate every day I get to sing Defying Gravity.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, look, speaking of Defying Gravity, I mean, I was going to ask you, do you have a favourite moment or song from the show?
I think probably the most magical moment is definitely Defying Gravity, because that's the moment when, you know, I get to fly, and just musically it's so well written for that moment. And, you know, and it feels pretty cool. You're up in the air and there's smoke and there's lights and all the ensemble are underneath and they're singing at you. And so it's pretty special. But then, you know, I obviously do the show every day. So then, you know, I have a bit of fun with Loathing, What Is This Feeling, with the ensemble. And they're all a bit mean to me and pulling funny faces at me. And it kind of changes. But I guess probably the most magical moment is Defying Gravity.
Well, I think we should have a listen to it. Thank you so much for your time today, Gemma.
Thank you so much.
That is Gemma Rick. She plays the part of the Wicked Witch of the West in Wicked the Musical. It's playing now in Melbourne. It opens in Sydney at the Capitol Theatre in September, and tickets are on sale now. Let's hear her singing Defying Gravity. This was live on Channel 7 Sunrise. Enjoy. Hope 103.2.
Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time to trust my instincts. Close my eyes and someone says they're so. Some things I cannot change, but till I try, I'll never know. Too long I've been afraid of losing love. I guess I've lost. Well, if that's love, it comes at much too high a cost. I'd sit by defying gravity. Kiss me goodbye. If we work in tandem, there's no fight we cannot win. Just you and I, defying gravity. With you and I, defying gravity. They'll never bring us down. No wizard that there is or was has ever gone to bring me down.
Of the many cuts announced in yesterday's budget, one of the biggest losers was the overseas aid budget, slashed by $7.6 billion. Tim Costello from World Vision is on the line for his response. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you firstly, earlier in the year, the government abolished AusAid, didn't they? What's been the impact of that?
Lots of focus on aid and really an absorption of Australia's aid program into really just trade. It's allegedly in this budget to save $400 million abolishing AusAid, but it's a very confusing message when Australians and other nations who are focused on keeping their promises to the world of delivering aid to people who are in absolute poverty don't have, in Australia, an aid agency, only a Department of Foreign Affairs. So we would say hasn't helped focus.
Yeah, and then coming off the back of that, now there's this $7.6 billion cut from the overseas aid budget. How will that affect your organisation, I guess, and others like it, and what you can accomplish in tackling overseas poverty?
Yeah, look, when I advocate increased aid, it's not self-pleading doing it for World Vision. We get less than 10% of our money from the government. Our donors are wonderfully generous, but certainly government monies, what was AusAid, is still the bigger share of humanitarian and development income that Australia gives. So it's about $1 billion that's raised privately, given to organisations like World Vision. It's $5 billion that comes out of the government, and this is therefore where the big prize is. That's why the rich nations of the world, including Australia, promised give 0.7% of their gross national product. That's 70 cents in every $100. That's an international promise, one kept by not just the Scandinavians and Dutch, but by Britain. And when a tale of two conservative leaders, this one, David Cameron, with double dip recession, slashing and burning the British budget, said, "We will not balance the books on the back of the poor." Britain are at 0.7%, 70%, 70 cents in every $100. Australia, by contrast, is at 34% or 0.34, 34 cents, going down now with the latest cuts to 29 cents. So this is why it's particularly devastating in a tale of two conservative leaders. Development, humanitarian issues should be above politics. This is our international promise, and to balance the books on the backs of the poor, repair our budget on the backs of the poor, I think is quite devastating.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, though, that you're not just concerned about the poor and the marginalised, you know, overseas. I think this budget's also raising concerns for the poor and marginalised in this country. So who would you be concerned about that might be worse off under this new budget?
Look, I'm very concerned for under 30s. I think this is very harsh to say 6 months wait before you can get onto New Start. Some will have families that are good families and can absorb them. Many don't. And I do think life is a waterbed. You press down in one place, it comes up in another. And the other place this will come up is homelessness, maybe crime. I think that's a real worry. We've got to remember that what a budget is a statement of moral priorities, not financial lines. And when we tax, we do it to raise revenue. We do it to redistribute to those who are most vulnerable and need it. We do it to reprice. So if things like carbon or aren't properly priced, a budget can do that. We do it to represent, to say the state and the citizen have a contract. You can trust the state to care for you. And this is the social contract that we talk about. And I think at each of those levels, we've been focusing on revenue and repairing the budget. But it's as if those who don't vote outside Australia, the absolute poor, are now being asked to actually pay the repair of the budget. Australian churches, Christian churches and young people are particularly the ones lobbying for those who don't have a vote in Australia. And just about every other lobbyist in town actually has self-interest. There's something coming back to their client, to them. That's how the system works around budget time. Here were churches and young people actually lobbying for people who have no vote, nothing coming back to them. It was, I think, the finest expression of Christian discipleship. I speak as a Christian here.
Yes.
And that's why I'm particularly devastated about this loss.
Okay, well, let's make sure that that Christian voice continues to be heard. Thank you, Tim, for filling us in a bit today.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
Tim Costello from World Vision with his response to the federal budget. One of the big changes in the Abbott government's first budget was an overhaul of Newstart, or the DOL, and the youth allowance. Young people who want to sign up for the DOL will be forced to wait 6 months before they receive any payments, after which time they can do 6 months of work for the DOL. After 6 months, their benefits will again be cut off for another 6 months. Tony Nicholson is the executive director of the Brotherhood of St Lawrence, who recently released an extensive study on youth unemployment. Hi, Tony.
Good morning.
Can you give us a bit of a picture of where we're actually at with youth unemployment in the country now?
Yes, well, it's well established. We've got a real problem with youth unemployment in Australia. Nationally, the rate is at about 12.5%, so that's more than double the rate of unemployment overall. But importantly, in some communities, it's as high as 20%. You see real hot spots almost in every state and territory, where there are communities with unemployment levels amongst youth between 15 and 20%. And it's growing. So the latest data shows that we have more than 56,000 young people in Australia who have been unemployed for longer than a year. So we've got this big problem that's only growing.
What impact do you think these welfare reforms will have on young unemployed people?
I have a real concern about them, but I will say that there is still a lot of detail to be released about these plans. So the budget papers are quite scant in detail. So I'm hoping the saving grace of these policies lies in the detail. But essentially, it's a radical departure from the approach that has been shown to be most effective. It is going to leave young people at risk of being left to their own devices for long periods of time. And we know that when young people are left to their own devices, they get dispirited, they become depressed, and they develop really bad habits.
Okay.
And so it's important that they be kept engaged and on the path to not only undertake training, but ultimately to get a job.
Yeah. Yesterday, Tim Costello said that he expected that some of these cost-saving measures would pop up later in either homelessness or crime figures. What do you think about that?
I think that's a big risk. Look, I really am deeply concerned about the circumstances of young people who don't have the support of family and can't live at home. And by my estimate, there would be something like 40 or 50,000 young people in Australia who are living independently. Now, if they are left in the circumstances where they don't have any income support, they'll become destitute, they'll become homeless. So it's going to be really important, if these plans are to be implemented, the detail of the implementation is going to be critically important to ensure that there are exemptions for young people in circumstances such as that.
The government's also intending to pay a subsidy to employers who take someone off the DOL queue, so paying the Newstart amount to their employer for 6 months. Do you think that incentive would make unemployed young people more attractive to employers?
It may at the margin. So what employers tell us is that, importantly, they look for skills and qualifications and experience. And if a young person doesn't have the training that equips them to undertake the job that the employer wants done, then any incentives, additional incentives from the government, won't change the employer's mind. It's only in circumstances where they're satisfied that the young person has the skills to undertake the job that they would take up that offer of the incentive from the government.
Okay. Well, what kind of government measure would help a long-term unemployed young person to get into work?
Well, what we have been able to demonstrate here at the Brotherhood of St Lawrence is that you can have great success in getting young people into work if you firstly provide them with good vocational advice so that they understand where the jobs are going to be in the future and how they need to prepare themselves to take advantage of those opportunities. Secondly, they need some training in the generic work skills that an employer is looking for, so how to work in a team, matters of occupational health and safety, importance of being able to take direction from a supervisor, those general skills, and thirdly, some work experience. Now, where we have put those three elements together and where employers have been happy to provide a young person with some unpaid work experience, we have had remarkable success in getting young people to land their first job. I think that's the combination of assistance that young people need. Now, whether these initiatives in the budget are able to provide that combination of assistance is at this stage uncertain.
Okay. Thanks, Tony. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
That's Tony Nicholson, the Executive Director of the Brotherhood of St Lawrence, talking about youth unemployment and changes to Newstart and Youth Allowance under the latest federal budget. Still to come on the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast, Ben McKechnie reviews Godzilla and Dr. Justin Colson questions the conventional approach of simply ignoring attention-seeking behaviour. But now, are today's kids wrapped in cotton wool? Well, most schools have a lot of playground rules. You know, no climbing trees, no bikes and scooters, that area is out of bounds, year two can only use equipment on Tuesdays and Fridays, etc. Well, a few years ago, a primary school in New Zealand threw out the playground rule book with some very surprising results. School principal Bruce McLaughlin joins us on the line from New Zealand. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Now, how did this little experiment come about for you?
We were asked to be part of a university study originally, and the idea of the study was to see if by changing a school playground in some way, you could cut down on bullying and obesity. It sounded like a great idea, so we took part in the study, but the way we ended up changing things was to throw out all the rules.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, there's a perception among some adults that if we don't watch kids like a hawk, their collective behaviour will just disintegrate into chaos in a matter of seconds, you know. But your school has really proven that that's not the case. What actually happened to the way, firstly, that the children played when you relaxed the rules a little?
Well, what children do when they play is actually what comes naturally to them. So it's not as if they are actually making a conscious effort to do something in particular. All they're doing is simply doing what comes naturally. And when you let children play basically freely, so you say to them, you know, there are no rules, just go out there and play, they find things to do. And they're obviously interested in certain things. So a child who loves climbing trees will head for the trees, and somebody else who loves riding their scooter will do that. So basically, kids at Swanson go off and do whatever they are really enjoying and wanting to do.
And I guess that makes the playground a more peaceful and happy place?
Well, it does, yeah. When you give kids the opportunity of doing anything they want to do, they are obviously very motivated and very engaged and very happy. I mean, think of it from our perspective as adults. If we had the opportunity to do anything we wanted to do, we would probably be doing the things that made us happy and engaged.
And so what are some examples of the more sort of creative or risk-taking activities that you've kind of let the kids do that in the past you would have just said no?
Well, things like climbing trees, when you actually have been involved in education for a long time and you've been a parent, and we've all become helicopter parents over the years, when you see a kid a long way up a tree, your immediate thought is that can go wrong. If a child climbs to the top of a 4 meter fence and there's concrete underneath, you think that could go wrong. Even when you see a child running across a piece of concrete, you think to yourself as an adult these days, they're going to fall over and they're going to hurt themselves. But of course, all of those things are natural. We simply want children to be safe, so we wrap them up in cotton wool, and in fact what we do when we do that is we take away their learning opportunities.
Okay, so how did changing the way the children could play impact on their actual learning in the classroom?
Well, we found that when children were totally motivated and engaged at break times, when they came back into class, they were much more ready to learn. So they were actually not doing all the little niggly things that happen after break times. When teachers help them to settle back into the classroom, they're often having to deal with all the conflicts that happen and the tales that are being told and all the little niggles. So that doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. We actually have fewer teachers on duty because we have less conflict in the playground. Children are not in conflict with each other because, in fact, they're engaged in what they're doing. But there is also little conflict and little injuries that are happening all the time, of course, but those are being dealt with by the children, not by adults. They're sorting things out for themselves. They're becoming much more independent.
Wow, that's exciting. Yeah. I'm speaking to Bruce McLaughlin, school principal of Swanson Primary School, where they have thrown out the playground rule book and have seen a lot of benefits. Bruce, I can imagine that one of the things you might have been concerned about is getting the parents on board, obviously, would be the first challenge. How did the parents react to the changes initially?
Well, we didn't actually make a formal announcement, and nor did we actually directly involve the parents, and we weren't consciously trying to exclude them. What we were simply doing was actually doing what we thought was right educationally at school, and all the parents were seeing were the children coming home happy. They were buzzing about their school day. They would probably notice that there were things that were different, such as, you know, Mr. Max says I can bring my scooter to school, mm, or my bike to school or whatever, or my skateboard to school. And so the parents would have noticed things like that. But if you're a parent and your child comes home buzzing with what they've been doing, and they're, you know, happy and often tired, you know, mm, which is even better if you're a parent, yeah, kids come home from school tired, then you're not likely to complain or you know, think, what's going on there? You're simply probably more likely to say, wow, this sounds great.
Were you concerned, though, that eventually, you know, when a child fell out of that tree and broke their arm or whatever, that parents might be more resistant? Have there been any teething problems as you've all adjusted to the new approach?
Remarkably few. But yes, I am paranoid about that. I don't want kids to be hurt because I care about kids. But equally, I don't want kids to be hurt while it's me who's in charge, because then I don't want to get the blame. That's a normal reaction. But I'm also an educator. I'm also a teacher. And I believe that what has to happen is that we as adults, as teachers, have to take a few risks as well. And our risk is to let kids get hurt, mm-hmm, because in the process of getting hurt, they're learning to manage their own risk. Mm. So yes, they probably will get a little bit hurt, but actually a little bit hurt is okay, and that's actually quite a hard decision to make.
Yeah, I mean, the school my daughter goes to, which is our local public school, I mean, you can't, like you said, ride a bike or a scooter. Everything's pretty much banned. You can't even wear a loom band because it might flick off and hit someone in the eye. Are you starting to see other schools adopting your approach, or is there still a lot of resistance?
There is still a lot of resistance, but after this international media attention, which has been amazing, people all over the world are very interested in this, and there are lots of schools and lots of individuals and lots of city councils who are very interested in freeing things up. But it isn't certainly a worldwide movement yet, and if it is, and if it becomes that way, well, that's great.
Do you think this would work at every school, and are there any sort of key elements that you need to make it work?
I actually think it would actually work anywhere, but I can understand fully why school authorities are reluctant. One of the things that makes New Zealand a more likely place for this to happen is that we have a Ministry of Education that gives schools considerable freedom. We also have a non-litigious environment, so parents don't tend to sue schools in New Zealand. They tend to remove their child if it's not what they want. And we also have ACC, which is the Accident Compensation Commission, and that's a national insurance scheme. And basically, if you get hurt doing anything, your medical costs for those accidental injuries are covered. So there's no need for New Zealanders to sue other people to get their medical costs back.
So you're not fearful of litigation, whereas perhaps in the United States, it's a very different picture.
Indeed, yeah.
Okay.
And so that would make it a little harder in some of those places. But the kind of reaction I have had to the story all over the world has been universally positive and wanting it to happen in other places as well.
Now, before I let you go, you did say at the beginning that the aim of the initial experiment was to reduce bullying and obesity. Have you seen any results with that?
Yes, our kids are very active. Some of them used to be active in the sense that they would be the ones who would always run around and play actively, but they were a small number of children. Nowadays, we see many, many more kids who are very active. So in terms of their fitness and the obesity, I'm sure that has probably got some change there. As far as bullying is concerned, that's fascinating. I don't see bullying anymore in the playground, and it doesn't mean we don't keep our eyes open, because you have to. The bullying's a human condition; it's not something that just happens in schools. But our bullies don't seem to bully anymore, and you've got to ask yourself, why is that? And I think it is because they're busy. Mm. Maybe bullies bully because they're bored, and so we
or frustrated.
Yeah, or frustrated because they're not allowed to do what they want to do. You know.
Yeah.
For whatever reasons, I think the university researchers are very interested in those sorts of things, and the study hasn't been published yet. The results of the study from the universities hasn't been published. So I don't know what their actual findings are going to be, but from our perspective, we see less bullying.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all that you've been learning there.
Not a problem.
Look forward to seeing a more adventurous playground here in Australia soon.
Good luck.
Yeah, thanks. It's Bruce McLaughlin from Swanson Primary School in New Zealand. They threw out the playground rule book and found the kids became a lot more resourceful and resilient. Now, Bruce McLaughlin is actually giving a TEDx talk about his experiences at Bond University on Friday. And, of course, that will be available on the internet some weeks later. 1 in 10 babies born in Australia today will develop a food allergy. That means you can expect at least 2 children in every classroom to have some form of food allergy. And while most people with allergies won't experience a life-threatening reaction, it's important for everybody to understand that food allergies can be very serious and even fatal. That's why everybody needs to be more allergy aware, but especially parents, those working in schools and childcare centres, restaurants and the catering industry, and friends, colleagues and family members of somebody who has a food allergy. That's just about everybody. Maria Said is the president of Allergy and Anaphylaxis Australia, who are behind Food Allergy Week. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Katrina.
Now, I often find as the parent of someone with food allergies that there's sort of a perception that we've got this food allergy thing all sorted now. Everybody gets it and there's not really a problem. What sort of issues do you hear about from your members that they face in managing food allergies?
Yeah, look, whilst we've come a long way with management of food allergy in Australia, there is still a way to go. We still have people having reactions. Certainly we have more work to do in the food service sector. The number of food recalls we have come through means that whilst packaged food, you know, has come a long way, we still have a way to go. Access to health professionals that have a good understanding and have expertise in food allergy are still lacking. We have a long way to go.
Yeah, certainly there's a very long waiting list to see any kind of allergy specialists in this country. I know part of your push for this Food Allergy Week is to want to see allergies made a national health priority. What do you mean by that, and what would you like to see happen?
Australia has, I think, about 9 national health priorities that are given increased attention, funding, resources and so forth. They include heart disease, they include diabetes, asthma. We want allergy to be up there. Allergic disease has increased in prevalence over the last 15-year period. I'm certainly including food allergy, but I'm not just talking about food allergy. I'm including eczema. I'm including allergic rhinitis. Allergic disease affects quality of life, and it's important that those that have any allergy are able to access the information and the support, the medication that they need to manage their way and have a good quality of life.
Yeah, with food allergies in particular, we talk a lot about management. It's about sort of learning to make the right decisions and recognising symptoms and responding. You know, is more research needed in trying to come up with a cure?
I'm hopeful that one day there will be a cure, but I have a 23-year-old son with peanut allergy, and since he was three, I've been told a cure is only 3 years away. I take my hat off to the researchers who are desperately looking to assist people who have food allergy. And whilst we certainly need to continue that work, we need to put just as much funding and share information about everyday management.
Mm-hmm. The thing that I find as a parent of a child with food allergy and the partner of an adult with a food allergy as well is that I find that it's very hit and miss when you go out to things like restaurants. It just really depends on the staff member you get as to whether you get any kind of understanding or whether you're completely dismissed. Would you like to see something a little bit more across the board in sort of the restaurant and catering industry to make sure that there's a greater awareness?
I certainly would. I think the restaurants and catering industry is where the packaged food industry was 20 years ago, and they were shaking their heads and saying no too hard. They are certainly now accepting that this is a problem and they need to tackle it, and they are hungry for information. We need to support the food industry so they can support us.
Okay. And what are some things that you'd like just ordinary folks to do for Food Allergy Week this week?
Understand that this isn't a fad, it's not a lifestyle choice, that people with a true immune system mediated food allergy don't have it because they've wanted it. We want them to be supported and we don't want them to be discriminated against. It's important that we do the simple things that can help make their life a little easier. People can go to our Food Allergy Week website, which is foodallergyaware.com.au. We're encouraging people to adopt an allergy, adults to adopt an allergy for a day or a week or a month. We're also asking people to paint a nail, one nail in 10, a different colour, to symbolise the 1 in 10 children that are now diagnosed with food allergy, the 1 in 10 babies that are diagnosed with food allergy.
Yeah, I know last time I painted my one nail and I waited all week for somebody to ask me about why I had one fingernail painted and nobody did, so...
Well, let me tell you, I painted my family's nails, my grown-up brothers each painted their nail and have gone off to work and
yep.
yesterday saying, oh gosh, if I got a dollar for every person that asked me about my nail.
I think for men get a bigger reaction. Thanks so much for sharing a little bit about Food Allergy Week today, Maria.
Thanks, Katrina.
That's Maria Said, the President of Allergy and Anaphylaxis Australia. They would love your donation during Food Allergy Week and you can find out more at foodallergyaware.com.au. How many times have you heard a parent say, oh, he or she is just doing that for attention, I'm just going to ignore it? But does ignoring attention-seeking behaviour actually work? Family expert Dr. Justin Colson from happyfamilies.com.au doesn't think so. Hi, Justin.
G'day, Katrina.
What are some fairly typical examples of attention-seeking behaviour?
Well, I've heard all sorts of things from parents, and I've got six of my own kids, so I've seen a fair bit of it as well. It could be anything from a toddler having a tantrum, and parents say, oh, look, it's just for attention, ignore it, he'll stop. There are five-year-olds who whine and moan, and they do that whiny, pouty thing. you can have tweens who they bash a ball or kick a wall or, slam a door, but keep on banging a door or something like that. I've even heard parents actually say, and this is quite frightening and tragic, about their 15-year-old girl who was cutting herself. Look, she's just doing it for attention.
Wow. Yeah, that's
I'm going to ignore her. Yeah, yeah. Their daughter was starving herself and cutting herself, but she was just doing it for attention. I'm going, well, give her some attention, for goodness sake.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, you often sort of hear the conventional wisdom or the prevailing view that you just ignore attention-seeking behaviour, that it will somehow stop. Does that actually work?
Now, the research actually suggests, and I think any parent who's had a child for more than a couple of months will discover that if we ignore a child when they're pleading for attention in whatever way they ask for it, it actually gets worse, not better. You know, our kids become clingier when they wonder if they're ever going to get any of our attention. Our kids whine more when we ignore them until they finally do just give up. But we have to actually break our child to get them to give up. And I'm not into breaking children. I think they should be built up, not broken down.
Okay. And so what is a better response? I mean, obviously, there's many different scenarios and situations, and maybe the response isn't always exactly the same, but what's an example of a better way to respond to something that is pretty classical attention-seeking behaviour?
Well, let me preface what I'm about to say by saying the context really does matter. You know, it really, there are some times where we simply have to do what has to be done. And that's horrible, but that's life. But when we don't find ourselves in that situation, I think that the number one thing that we should do is actually give our kids the attention. See the world through their eyes. You know, normally when our kids are behaving in a way that makes it look like they're seeking attention, parents will actually say, oh, they're being naughty. You know, there's a problem with having a tantrum. The child is being naughty or behaving badly. I don't think so at all. I think that what's really going on is there is an unmet need in that child, and they're expressing it in whatever way they know how. Quite often, they don't have the skills to say, you know, I'm really perturbed and somewhat disturbed, Mum, by the catastrophic nature of what's occurring. And, you know, they don't have that sort of vocabulary. They're not going to talk to us about it. They just scream and throw a fit. Mm-hmm. So number one, understand, don't reprimand. See the world through their eyes. Number two, I actually think we should get involved in time in with them instead of time out. A lot of parents say, if you're going to tantrum, get out of my sight and stay there until you've calmed down. I disagree. I actually think that we should say, you're having a really hard time. Let me stop what I'm doing and engage with you. Okay. And it's amazing. We do that for somewhere between 60 seconds and 5 minutes, and we have brand new children who are happy and balanced and feeling good about life again. You know, I'm in the car and one of my kids is having a meltdown. I pull the car over. I get them out of the car. And I hug them, and I let them know that I love them and that I understand that sometimes it's really hard. Every now and again, I've been late for something because of that. Mm-hmm. But whenever we've gotten back into the car, we've done it happily, and the rest of the ride has been a positive one.
Now, what about, say, a more sort of simple sort of interaction, such as Mum's been with toddler all day, they've had some lovely interactions, then at about 3 o'clock, she needs to find that friend who's going through a really tough time, and the second Mum gets on the phone, toddler then tugs on Mum's legs, you know, makes a lot of noise, starts throwing themselves off the couch. What's your advice in that sort of situation where, you know, yes, the toddler has a need, but there's someone else's need as well, and that's the friend on the other end of the phone?
Yeah, just one piece of advice for that, and that is be proactive. Mm-hmm. So think about what you're about to do and what's going on in your toddler's world, let's say, or your child's world. Let's say, you know, it's 6 o'clock at night, everyone's tired and hungry, but this emergency has come up and your attention is going to be distracted. Take 1 minute. Explain to your child, for the next 15 minutes, I have to do something and I can't be interrupted. And then look for ways that you can set them up so that they can successfully follow what you're asking. Mm-hmm. For some people, you might just give them an iPad and say, you can play on the phone or the iPad for 15 minutes while I do this. That'll sort it out. If you're not into using technology as a tool in those instances, then you might find something else that the child can do so that they'll be engaged and they won't have a need for your attention and they won't be tantruming while you're doing that. It really comes down to proactivity.
I guess it's how you set things up in the beginning sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Justin. Some good thoughts there.
Always a pleasure.
That's Dr. Justin Colson. He's now father of 6 girls, a parenting author, and the founder of happyfamilies.com.au. The world's most famous monster, Godzilla, is back on the big screen today. Our film reviewer, Ben McKechnie, has survived the epic Godzilla experience last night. Hi, Ben.
Katrina, you're right. I did. I came out unbruised, unscathed.
Amazing. And I've been trying to dig up details about the plot of this movie because I have to confess, I've never seen a Godzilla movie. But all I've been able to unearth, Ben, is that an extremely enormous and powerful monster wreaks mass destruction on planet Earth. Is there more to it than that?
There is more to it, but you pretty much summarised what Godzilla is in a nutshell. That's like the ten. That's about 10 words, wasn't it? That's about 10 words or less summary of what Godzilla is. And Godzilla's been doing this now for, oh, it's been 50 years. The first Godzilla was a Japanese film in the 50s, and it was a bit of a reaction to atomic warfare. And so Godzilla was this giant kind of dinosaur lizard freak creature that had mutated because humans had, you know, got their war on, got too atomic and got too nasty towards each other. They created this nuclear potential, and then that had backfired because this dinosaur lizard thing had mutated and started smashing the Earth.
So it's kind of almost like a fable against nuclear war.
Yeah, it was. It definitely was in the 50s, and for as cheesy as the original movie was, like a lot of those other monster movies around the time also had this like atomic warfare, nuclear war fear going on underneath. So there was like a deeper undercurrent to it. But the new version that we've got now, they actually dial that back quite a long way. I was surprised. I thought they'd really go harder on the kind of the war angle or you know, look what humans do to the planet. But this one is more, the emphasis seems to be much more on purely the arrogance, and this is a line from the movie, the arrogance of humans to think that they can control nature. That seems to be, if you want to look for a message in a movie where all these monsters, because Godzilla fights some other monsters in this movie, if you want to look for a deep message in a movie where monsters smash a bunch of cities around the world, this movie, Godzilla, this version, seems to be suggesting that we shouldn't be so arrogant as to think we can control nature.
Ah, there you go. Well, that was my next question for you, Ben, so you've already answered that one.
Do you think people go to these movies looking for messages, or are we just going along because we want to see stuff blow up?
Well, see, I was wondering why people go to see these movies from the comfort of their cushioned cinema chair, and I was wondering if it's because when you then step outside, it makes the real world seem a lot safer. I wonder if it sort of comforts us because going through this terrible ordeal of seeing like this absolute destruction, you then walk outside and go, oh, life's pretty good.
Yeah, which is, I think you're right. I think you're onto something, and which is kind of, I'm looking for a better word than perverse, but it seems a little bit perverse given when we walk outside into the world and look around, natural disasters do happen quite a bit, and we don't find them entertaining. Like everything from a tsunami to an earthquake, whatever it might be, people aren't entertained by those things in real life. Like they're horrible disasters. And yet we go to movies often, and Godzilla is just the latest in a string of movies. And, you know, anything from Noah recently this year to, you know, movies like The Day After Tomorrow. And then you chuck in the alien ones like Independence Day and all that kind of stuff. But we like to go and watch big disaster movies. And yet in real life, really don't like disasters. It's quite an interesting phenomenon.
Do they actually fight back again? Is there like this hope that they're going to beat the monster?
That's a great question, and I'll try to phrase this without giving too much away about the movie, but it was one of the interesting things I thought about this version of Godzilla, which on one hand is unnecessary. We don't need another Godzilla movie. On the other hand, it's big and stuff blows up, and that's all very entertaining. But no, for a lot of the film, you don't get the sense that there's any hope for humans, as in that humans can stop nature, that humans can stop nature. So depending on how you feel about that, like you can almost kind of sit back and think, well, what's the point? Why are humans here? They're just sort of sitting back and waiting to get demolished. Which then when you walk outside the cinema, there's a fair comment about real life there, in that there are things that humans can control. And then there is just so much else that's beyond our control. And this movie, and it's what it's saying about us and how we shouldn't be so arrogant to think we can control nature. I think there's something to that. And me as a Christian makes me think even beyond that and just think, who's controlling nature? And how could we ever be so arrogant as to think that we can control that force behind nature, which is God? So after coming out of Godzilla, I thought a bit more about God, but I'm not sure if that's the intention of those that made Godzilla.
Okay, fair enough. Now, but speaking of God, though, you are also hosting a special screening of Son of God with City Bible Forum on Monday, June the 2nd. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So Son of God is based from the makers of that TV series, The Bible, that was really popular last year. And so Son of God focuses on the Gospels, on the Jesus story. So myself and Empire Magazine senior editor Dave Brown will be hosting a Q&A session on June the 2nd after a screening of the movie, and we're going to be talking about Jesus on the big screen. So we want to talk about stuff like how Jesus is represented on screen, what we learn about Jesus on the big screen, and what's left out when we go see a movie about Jesus. So it's on June 2 at the Chevelle Cinema at Paddington. And for more information, you can go to City Bible Forum's website.
Okay, great. That's citybibleforum.org. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much, Katrina.
That's Ben McKechnie, our film reviewer. That panel discussion, Monday, June 2nd, citybibleforum.org.